I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, two conversations with young Iraqis seeking refuge in the U.S. We'll find out how it's going. But first, the price of oil is edging towards $100 a barrel. Oil prices closed at more than $96 a barrel yesterday. They are moving up. 8 years ago, oil was trading at $16 a barrel. Also today, the Energy Department reported that U.S. oil supplies dropped for a third straight week. Vahan Janjigian is executive director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. He joins us with some quick analysis. And Vahan, first of all, do you think oil will hit $100 today?
No, I don't think we're going to hit it today because, as you said, the oil inventories did drop. However, the drop was not as much as expected. So as a result, the prices have actually backed off a little bit from their earlier highs today. So I don't think we're going to hit it today.
Well, you know, we're reading reports of, there's good news for several countries in the news of rising oil prices. Russia, for instance, which has pockets bulging with oil profits, has been investing in other countries. But what does this news mean for the U.S.?
Well, for consumers, it's really bad news because, as we've seen recently, oil prices have really gone through the roof, but gasoline prices have not. They've been relatively stable, but in the last few days, gasoline prices have started to climb, and many analysts have been saying that eventually they have to catch up to this rise in oil. So even if we don't go above $100 per barrel, even if we remain at current levels, it's inevitable that gasoline prices are likely to rise on average maybe another 20 or 30 cents per gallon.
Other countries may not feel it as the U.S. does. For instance, in Europe, where consumers are already hit with really high taxes on the price of gasoline, for instance. They don't necessarily feel the rise of the price of the oil because they're already paying in the taxes. Do you agree with that thinking?
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that. However, the Europeans also have another advantage that we don't. They get to buy their fuel in euros. We have to pay dollars, and the dollar has really been sinking. In fact, it's the fall in the dollar which has actually contributed to some of the rise in the price of oil, because oil is a dollar-denominated commodity.
In some countries, they're talking about rising fuel prices igniting, civil unrest. India, for instance, perhaps in China as well, where a man was killed jumping a line to buy gas in one of the cities there. Those are the two countries that are said to also be driving the price of oil up because they have so many more consumers than they did before. But, some analysts are saying, well, actually, higher oil prices are a sign that the economy, the world global economy, is doing well because these growing economies in countries like India and China need more oil. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that higher demand for oil is a sign that economies are doing well. Higher prices are not necessarily a sign, however. The price is actually a result of supply and demand, and the reason prices have gone up so much is because we're in a situation now because of all the marginal demand coming out of countries like India and China, which in the past did not use a lot of oil. That marginal demand has contributed to a situation where supplies are now very tight, and as a result, we are basically consuming everything we produce, whereas in the past, we used to have a lot of slack in the system. So because economies are doing well and because there's no slack in the system, prices are going way up. And I think it's really going to take a slowdown in world economies in order to bring the price back down again.
Which doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
Well, it could happen. I mean, we are starting to see a slowdown in the United States, and some people are actually saying that there's a possibility of a recession. And if that happens, we could see a drop in the price of oil because, as you know, the United States is the biggest consumer.
And if people aren't driving, buying things, et cetera, the demand will go down and the price will drop?
That's right, yes. Once we see a reduction in demand, we will see the price drop again. But, of course, as the price drops, demand may pick up again. So it does tend to be a vicious cycle.
Vahan, just another quick consumer tip, if you could do that as well. Is it too late to lock into home heating fuel prices?
No, I don't think it's too late. You can lock in virtually any time. And, of course, the reason you would lock in is because you would expect heating oil prices to rise. My advice would be to do that because we're about to go into a heavy driving season again with Thanksgiving and Christmas coming down the road. And the demand for higher gasoline also means that there will be less heating oil available on the market. So it might make sense to lock in now.
Vahan Janjigian, executive director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. Vahan, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin.
More than 120 journalists have been killed in Iraq since 2003. and most of them have been Iraqi. One of them was 32-year-old Salah Saif al-Din, a native of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, who began reporting for The Washington Post after the war started. Last month, Saif al-Din was killed by a single gunshot to the forehead after he went to cover a story alone, as he usually was, in one of Baghdad's most dangerous neighborhoods. Saif was the first Washington Post Iraqi correspondent to die. His colleagues called him their Teflon correspondent, a tenacious reporter's reporter who risked his life because, as he said, what's life, really, if we don't leave something good behind? Well, 27-year-old Bassam Septi was a colleague of Saif al-Din's. He was a special correspondent for The Washington Post in Baghdad from 2003 to 2006. Bassam is now in the second year of a creative writing program at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He begins our look today at Iraqis in the U.S., how dangerous the life they left, how they're handling their new life now. Bassam joins us from a radio studio at St. Joseph's. Bassam, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And first of all, I'm so sorry about the loss of your colleague.
Thank you very much. It was a loss, actually, for all Iraqis and also Americans. And actually, it was a loss for the whole world.
Well, why? Tell us more. I mean, you know, obviously you've all risked your life, all the Iraqi reporters. But this guy seemed to go the extra mile.
Exactly. Saleh was one of the most courageous reporters I've ever seen in my life. He was one of those whom you rarely find going to battlefields and to cover the news. And Saleh never hesitated to go there and do the reporting, even when the clashes are taking place there.
You once took information from him and you could hear the bullets flying behind him.
Exactly. That was, I think, in 2005. And he was in his hometown in Tikrit, as you mentioned earlier. And he used to report there before he was threatened and came to Baghdad.
Well, let's tell people why. He had a huge expose. He exposed a scandal involving Iraqi police torturing and killing an Iraqi civilian.
Yes, the story was bigger than what we expected. It's the police chief there was involved in this. And Saleh was threatened. He was almost kidnapped. He was beaten on the road, and he was tortured as he was beaten. And when he came to Baghdad, he was in a very bad shape, to the extent that I thought that he should have gone to the hospital immediately.
Anthony Shadid is another one of the Washington Post reporters who wrote a great appreciation of your friend. He wrote, he'd come to the office all bruised, and all I could think of was, what happened to the other guy? Because he had that sort of reputation for, you know, he would always win, but on this one day he didn't. He was shot and killed. You know, you risked your life as well. In fact, you were an interpreter for the Christian Science Monitor reporter Jill Carroll at one point. Another one of her interpreters was shot right in front of her when she was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. So you were well aware of the danger as well.
Of course. Well, it's when I started working, actually, in this field in 2003, it wasn't as bad as it is now. And I remember when I worked with Jill Carroll in 2003, actually in July 2003, life wasn't that dangerous, and we could basically drive in the streets, go wherever we wanted, and did the reporting. But in early 2004, things started getting worse, and that's how I started to have my own precautions. Because the notion among insurgents and militias is that anyone who works for any American institution, media outlet, hospital, whatever it is considered a spy in their eyes.
Yeah. So why, given how dangerous it was, you know, why did you do it?
Well, for me, it's an ethical thing, a moral thing. Basically, Iraq is my country. Iraq is a place that I don't want to see suffering anymore. And we suffered for a long time under Saddam, under the sanctions. I was born in 1980. I've never seen peace in Iraq since 1980. Three successive wars, 12 years of sanctions. And I thought this war would be the end of the suffering. And I was so wrong, because this started a new era of suffering for Iraqis. And since day one I worked, I decided not to work because of money, or because I wanted it, or because I speak English, or whatever. I just thought that people in the world should know what is happening. I know some people, unfortunately, don't care anymore, but I'm hoping that someday, somewhere, there will be someone who's going to care about this and try to find a way to stop this craziness.
Do you think people really don't care?
I have to say it, in the U.S., I can say the majority of people don't care anymore. They actually deliberately sometimes don't want to listen to the news anymore because they said, like, we're fed up, we're bored, every day we hear car bombs. It hurt me, and one day I wrote something about Iraq, and my classmate said, you know, Bassam, I don't really even remember there's a war these days until I either see you or talk to you or read something that you wrote. And I was shocked because she was like a 29-year-old graduate student in creative writing, and she is like an adult, educated, and she says such a thing. And okay, I just thought this about it this way. Forget about Iraqis, forget about the war or the suffering Iraqis are going through, but your country is involved in this war. Your friends are in the army. They are dying. They are being killed. They are like protecting you while you're all here. And you just don't remember or don't think there is a war. That was one of the incidents that I came across.
Well, I'm wondering if what you might be hearing, you know, there are Americans who feel that the situation might be hopeless in Iraq. They didn't want to go in the first place. There are Americans who are passionately concerned with what happens with Iraq, and there are others who it does feel like it's the same kind of news over and over, and they just can't take it in, you know, because it just feels relentless. What would you want Americans to know about Iraq, that they're, you know, something that maybe they're not knowing that might compel them to care more?
Well, I think they should read stories, and that's of course part of the jobs reporter to do. They should read stories about normal Iraqis, because basically we are not like monsters. We're not like not all of us are insurgents, for instance. We don't kill each other. I don't kill my neighbors. My neighbor doesn't kill me. It's a matter of political struggle. It's a matter of insurgents and militias are trying to take over the country, and the people are stuck in the middle.
Well, given that violence still plaguing Iraq, will you go back? Your student visa expires in May.
I have to tell you that I'm torn. I don't know whether I can go back now. I'm thinking of taking the PhD degree after I finish the master's, hoping that in a few years maybe the country will get better and then I can go back and help my country with the degree that I got.
Bassam Sebti was a special correspondent for the Washington Post in Baghdad from 2003 to 2006. He's now in the second year of a creative writing program at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. Bassam, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And just ahead, we'll catch up with an Iraqi who worked as a translator for the U.S. in Iraq. She's now living with a Here and Now listener who offered her a home, but how's the job search going? And later, it could be the biggest budget battle in years in Congress, sparring over spending while the veto pen is poised at the White House. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now. We're continuing our conversations with Iraqis in America now with a 30-year-old Asma Abdi. She worked as an Arabic translator for the U.S. State Department and military in Iraq and came to the U.S. earlier this year with the help of a former Massachusetts state trooper and under a special program to bring in a few hundred Iraqi translators. We first spoke with Asma back in April. After that interview, a Here and Now listener opened her home to Asma, but since then, she's been job hunting and doing occasional work as a translator and part-time work as a hospital administrator. We recently asked her, how are things going?
Well, I'm more realistic. I don't want to look back anymore. I'm here in the United States. I have to face it. No way to get back together with my family, I think, for the time being.
Well, tell us where your family is. Your parents are...
In Syria.
On a visa.
They renew it monthly.
Well, now, is it safe to say they fled Iraq for Syria?
Fled the country.
Well, what happens with their visa? What's their status?
They are waiting for my brother to take them to Finland, but the first application was rejected by Finnish embassy.
Because your brother had already gone to Finland ahead
of
your parents.
Yeah, he's a citizen.
And you have a sister in Jordan.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're all flung all over the place.
Yeah.
you could say, well, you're safe, you know. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, what I'm facing in the United States, I don't think it's a big deal, but it's away from my mom and dad. And my mom and dad, they are not, you know, get used to live in another country. They're getting old. In fact, I cannot bring my mom and dad because I cannot afford their living here in the United States. And they need the health insurance. And for me also, I don't have a health insurance in this country.
Hmm. Well, that's tough, you know, being separated from family.
Yeah.
You say you don't have it so bad here relative to other people. But what are some of the other challenges you've encountered here?
Oh, so many. I mean, the American government was generous with me enough to get me green card, but I was looking for a job. Hmm. I thought like maybe a training, give lectures about culture, Iraqi dialect for the troops who are going back to Iraq. I thought like there will be some translation job with the government because I used to work for the government, American government in Iraq. I used to be polygraphed every year. And every day I have been x-ray before I got to the embassy, a chemical detector, metal detector. It could be 3 times or 4 times before I got to the embassy. So at least I'm a trustable person.
You're trusted, yes.
Yeah, so I thought like they can offer me a job, but so far I'm not so lucky. Could be my dream is not coming so soon, but I'm going to work on it.
You felt that you would get a job from the government. Do you think that they've let you down?
I don't know if they let me down or not, but I told you they are generous, but maybe this has not brought their attention.
Well, you know, what would you say, though, Asma, to there are a lot of Americans, you know, looking for jobs who see themselves as ahead of you on the line, you
but
know?
I thought it's equal opportunity. Yeah. So if I am Iraqi, this is not should be an obstacle to me. People should trust me and rely on my experience. Give me a time. Give me a chance.
Do you feel, you've had someone open their home to you, so you've obviously had really good experiences. What do other people say when they hear that you're Iraqi and recently arrived and you were a translator for the military? What kind of response do you get?
Some of them, it's okay, the people who had experience in the Middle East. But some people, I don't know, they have a reaction that I'm Iraqi, you know, I'm supposed to be different, but I'm not different.
Like, what do you mean?
Like I have 2 eyes, 1 nose, 1 mouth. That's what I'm saying.
And they look at you like, you can't be Iraqi.
You yeah, and you have English and you are speaking.
And you're very fashionable looking and sophisticated. And we recently saw Ramadan.
Yes.
Here. And were you able to fast and do what you
needed to do? Yeah, I was able to fast. One family was so generous with me. They invite me to Islamic breakfast. And that's...
Breakfast, that's the evening meal, right?
Yeah, this is the evening. We fasted from sunrise to sunset.
Yeah.
Every day for about 28 days. So it was like, it's that meal that all the family members will be together. This year, I didn't see my family. And I just talked to them on the phone.
Yeah.
And they are to ask me if I'm still fasting, following up the customs and the culture. I says yes.
Given that, you know, and the difficulty finding work, has the right thing happened, or do you wish you were back in Iraq? You don't want to say?
Yeah.
Obviously, that's hard for you to answer. But maybe, I mean, the Iraq that you miss, I don't know, it's not safe.
Yeah.
And the people you love aren't there.
Yeah. Can we cover another subject?
Sure.
If it's about another job opportunity, if I go back to Iraq as the same job that I used to have in the green zone, it will be for 12,000. I used to get 700.
But that must be awfully tempting for you to see your job, you know, when you made 700 there, to know that you can make 12,000
per month
for that same job.
Yeah, and if I pass my 6 month, I could take 15,000. Per month.
Oh, that must be tempting.
I know, but I don't want to go back to Iraq. I don't want to lose my courage and say one day, yes, I'm going back to Iraq.
You can't go back because it's what we call a catch-22.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though it would be money that you couldn't have dreamed of when you lived there, it's too dangerous for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I can even bring my family and my mom and dad if I accept this job. Mm. But I cannot guarantee that I will stay one piece. I ran away from war. I was trying to survive. I flee. I just want to get myself here to United States in one piece. I was dreaming that one day I will not be alive. Every day, the death is in my mind. I said, like, if I'm going to die, that's it. Mm. But, like, after I'm here, I'm hesitating to get back to Iraq.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen in Iraq? People have talked about it being divided into three different provinces. And, well, you know, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, let me tell you, I'm so confused. I'm watching a lot of American programs. Seriously, I'm confused. I don't know what's the next step and what the future will be. Nobody knows, even most of Iraqis. Mm. And I think the same thing with Americans. They do not know the answer.
Asma, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks to have me here.
Asma Abdi worked as an Arabic translator for U.S. advisors while she lived in Iraq. She now has a green card and is living in the Boston area. And as she said, if she were hired here to do the same job, she'd make about 17 times more. Okay, still ahead, what's going on in Congress? Back after the news, here and now. The biggest budget showdown in years is brewing on Capitol Hill, reminding many of 1995, when a bitter budget dispute caused a partial government shutdown. Analysts predict it's only going to get worse heading into next year's election, because both parties are trying to define their differences for voters, perhaps at the expense of compromise. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Capitol Hill. And Gail, this dispute is playing out in a lot of bills. One's the Popular Water Projects bill. President Bush already vetoed it, but the House late last night, apparently a lot of drama, overrode that veto. What's the buzz today after that late night? Are people saying it's as bad as 95?
Well, people learn from 95. Newt Gingrich took the Republicans roaring into that showdown with the president with the idea that they could actually make some big gains in the polls, and exactly the opposite happened. People don't like it when their Social Security checks stop coming. So I think there's a lot of reluctance to take quite that tact. I think what you're more likely to see is ongoing deadlocks, clashes, position to statements to everyone's key interest groups, continuing resolutions, and perhaps something like what we saw with the last Congress, where you just punt the bills into the next year.
Well, right now, more than a month into the federal fiscal year, the government is operating on a stopgap spending measure. None of the 12 annual spending bills have been passed yet.
That's right.
But staying with the Waters bill that was, the veto that was overridden last night, if the Senate does that as well, it's now passed on to the Senate, it would be the first time a Bush veto has been overturned. What is the president's objection to the water bill?
Spends too much money. He doesn't like some of the earmarks in it as well. He's looking to make a statement about a fiscal discipline to try to bring back very angry conservative voters. Now, I don't see there's any way that this veto is not overturned in the Senate. 81 senators voted for this bill. And what I'm hearing when I talk to Republicans is this. Look, this bill doesn't actually spend money. It just authorizes spending money. So therefore, it's not a bad thing to overturn the veto. So they tell me that this isn't the start of a wedge between Republicans on Capitol Hill and the president, that when it comes to actually spending real money with those appropriation bills, the House still has 147 Republicans on record saying that they will sustain a veto for anything over what the president wants to spend.
Well, the spending is at the heart of all the bills. House yesterday also approved a $215 billion bill to pay for health, education, and veterans programs. The president has threatened to veto that. There was a refrain during the House debate over the water bill, with the Democrats criticizing the president for previously resisting what they describe as just slight increases in health care, education. Well, at the same time, asking for money for wars. Here's Democrat Corrine Brown of Florida. Let's listen.
It is hard for me to understand how President Bush can spend $600 billion on his never-ending war, but yet veto $23 billion in vital water and civil work projects for the cities and towns right here in America.
Well, and at the same time, Gail, we are reading that Democrats are struggling with the strategy, how to approach the president's priorities. Jim Nussle, director of the Office of Budget and Management, said in the New York Times today that there's a lot of confusion.
Well, the argument is it's a tough one to sell at a time when you're also saying to the Republicans, look, you're spending hundreds of billions on a war off budget. We ought to be sacrificing for this war. We ought to be paying for it now. And then at the same time say, oh, by the way, since you're already spending so much, what's another $22 billion among friends? You know, it's not a consistent argument. So that's why they're having trouble selling it. And it doesn't go anywhere near far enough for the Democratic base that wants to see a very clear and strong vote on getting out of the war, getting out of a combat role, and starting moving troops home. So that's what I'm looking at right now. What's going to happen when the defense bill comes up? The House Democrats are talking about adding some bridge funds to that, not giving the president all that he wants on war funding, but just part of it, and attaching some more conditions, such as you must begin a withdrawal, be out by a goal of December 2008.
Well, and meanwhile, Republicans, some of whom feel they're being punished at the polls were punished in 2006 because the party is no longer seen as representing fiscal responsibility, may be able to seize that issue back when it comes to the farm bill. The House endorsed a status quo sort of rewrite of farm policy, and the White House is accusing Democrats of maintaining these crop subsidies for big crops, especially in seven states where there's, you know, that are in play for the 2008 election. And it may be the president that is sort of taking what would some would say is the higher fiscal road on this issue.
That's right. President's argument is, look, this is, you know, $25 billion above a baseline. That's just too much. And when you actually break it down and look at some of the farmers with incomes well over, you know, $200,000, do we really need to add subsidies to rich corporate farms? That also is an argument that plays against the Democratic kind of populist. We are opposing helping rich people. We favor supporting the middle class and poorer people. The Republicans, I think, can seize this and again put the Democrats on the defensive. They're having a lot of difficulty finding some traction in these funding battles right now.
Indiana Republican Richard Lugar and New Jersey Democrat Frank Lautenberg in the Senate want to stop the practice of subsidizing corn, wheat, soybeans, crops that are driving so many other problems, as the Boston Globe editorializes today. Corn, for instance, the excess corn is what's driving obesity because the corn syrup's going into products because it's so cheap. So the Democrats are being positioned as, being behind obesity, poor farmers in other countries not able to make money on their crops because of the subsidies in this country and the excess going abroad. It feels as if the Democrats are really losing control of this issue through the farm bill.
That's exactly what's happened. And that is a bill that in the past has been bipartisan. And it's a sign of how, you know, every senator has a farmer in their state. It's a sign of how really bitter and divisive this process has been. I just left a Republican staffer and I said, look, what are you feeling right now about what's happening with these bills? And he just said, it's just morose.
Well, morose.
Morose.
I don't know. Do we leave it on that note? We have just a few seconds, Gail, or do you think there's going to be some shift?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll leave it on a very happy note. I just sat through French President Sarkozy's speech to the joint House and Senate, and it was just a love fest. Standing ovations, cheering on all sides. At one point, the president said every time an American falls overseas, he thinks of what Americans did for France in World War II, and both sides, with tears in their eyes, leaped to their feet and cheered. So we don't have to leave on a morose note.
So French fries might be back in Washington.
They're definitely back today.
Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And before we go today, the story of a polygamous wife. You're listening to Here and Now.
Get to the bottom!
Police in Islamabad, Pakistan, swung batons and fired tear gas outside Parliament today in clashes with supporters of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto after lawmakers formally endorsed President General Pervez Musharraf's state of emergency. Bhutto calls Musharraf's authoritarian measures a breach of trust and told supporters to defy a ban on protests that began Saturday when Musharraf suspended the Constitution. He has since ousted independent judges, put a muzzle on the media, and granted police sweeping powers to crush dissent. Thousands of people have been arrested. In an editorial in today's New York Times, Bhutto calls on the UN to tell Musharraf to lift martial law and hold elections within 60 days. Susanna Koster, a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, also spoke briefly with Bhutto in Islamabad yesterday. Here's that interview in its entirety.
How do you see your political future here?
Well, my political future is tied up with the political future of Pakistan and whether it stays as a democratic state or turns into a dictatorship. I'm deeply worried that nuclear-armed Pakistan is heading towards an internal implosion. There's been a rise of extremism, and instead of concentrating on battling the terrorists, the government is diverting its energies against lawyers, political activists, and the press, the very elements of a civil society that are needed to confront terrorism.
Do you see any role left for Musharraf?
Well, I'm very puzzled by General Musharraf's action. My party and I had been in negotiations with him to give a peaceful political alternative, and we had warned him that its election would be controversial. I had advised him to seek re-election from the next assembly, but by choosing to go through this assembly, a constitutional crisis was created, and now we have to move out of it. I don't think the answer is postponing elections. I think General Musharraf should keep his commitment to retire as Chief of Army Staff, and he should keep his commitment to hold the elections called on November 15th for January 16th.
Will there be any role for him? Do you see any role for him in the future?
It is not for me to decide a role. It is for the people of Pakistan to decide a role.
And what will you do? Will you join the protests?
Yes, we are very much part of the protests. Our people have been arrested. People's Party is the most popular party in the country, so 50% of the people who have been arrested, if not more, belong to the Pakistan People's Party.
And many people have been arrested, also political leaders. You're still here. You're still free, in a way, so to speak. Why is that?
Well, perhaps it is because I have a well-known image as a twice-elected Prime Minister of Pakistan. I have not been arrested now, but I don't know whether I'll be arrested tomorrow. The situation is very uncertain, but I do know one thing, that we have to defuse the internal crisis and concentrate on the real battle, which is against the rise of extremism, and for that we must go towards democracy. I thank the international community for speaking up for democracy, but I think that pressure needs to be exercised more greatly so that General Musharraf knows that his regime would not be bailed out by the international community if it failed to keep its commitments for democracy.
One more thing. Why has it taken a couple of days for you to respond in this way?
I responded on November 1st. Before leaving Pakistan, there were reports swirling that there might be emergency. So I gave a very categorical statement that there should be no, that People's Party would resist that. And then when I went to Dubai on November 2nd, I met with Mr. Nawaz Sharif's a member of his party, to tell him that I was disturbed about these reports and to ask his advice on how he thought the political forces could work together to thwart democracy. And since I returned on the 3rd, I had meetings with other political parties like the SNP and the BNP. This morning I spoke to Asma Jahangir, the chairman of the United Nations, the former rapporteur, as well as to Mr. Afsandiar. So I have been very busy coordinating and seeing how all the different political forces can move together towards the agenda of ending military rule in this country.
Former Pakistan Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto speaking with Susanna Koster, correspondent for the website csmonitor.com. Bhutto is calling for nationwide demonstrations on Friday. We'll follow that story. Also tomorrow, U.S. troops training in fake Iraqi villages in the U.S. We'll have that. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Utah's Salt Lake Tribune reports today that the state has lost its federal funding for a program that provided services to victims of domestic violence in polygamous families. The money also paid for a county deputy to patrol the town of Hilldale. Now, that's important because you might remember Hilldale is home to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a breakaway sect disavowed by mainstream Mormons. And just about everyone in Hilldale, including the police, is a follower of polygamist Warren Jeffs, who's awaiting sentencing after his conviction for arranging a marriage to a minor girl. Irene Spencer once lived what she describes as this suffocating life of polygamy. A member of a fourth-generation polygamous family, she became the second of ultimately 10 wives of her brother-in-law, Verlin LeBaron, and she became a member of his fundamentalist sect, the Church of the Firstborn. When the family compound was raided, she moved with him to Mexico, where she lived in poverty and in fear of Verlin's brother-in-law, Irvil, who, she writes, ordered the deaths of 28 people. Through all of this, Irene bore Verlin 13 children, adopted another, and would eventually have over 100 grandchildren. And then she left. She says she realized the punishing God she was taught to worship didn't exist, but also no one would acknowledge how terrible it was for the women, children, and men who lived the life. Irene Spencer's memoir is Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamous Wife, and she joins us from the studios of KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I wonder what your thoughts were as you watched the Jeffs trial. I mean, during the course of the last couple of years in Utah, we saw polygamous families gather on the statehouse steps, and we saw women who were followers of Warren Jeffs. What did you see in these women?
Well, in him, I knew his father very well, and I had four of my sisters that were in his group.
When you say sisters, do you mean your sister wives?
No, my siblings.
Ah.
I had four of my siblings that were in Warren Jeffs' group, and they were actually had their daughters just placed and married off to men old enough to be their fathers or grandfathers. Mm.
But you write that you see in the eyes now that you've left the sect, you see in the eyes of these women sort of a deadness.
They're taught that they cannot have a salvation without being married. And in our religion, we're taught that your husband is your savior. He's the one that's going to take your hand and lead you through the veil into heaven. And if you don't do what he asks you to do and be obedient, then you're not going to be able to receive your exaltation. For that very reason, I attended four of my husband's weddings. I actually took the bride's hand and put it in his and gave her to him for time and for all eternity. And I did it without crying or flinching because I wanted to be found worthy that I might be able to be a goddess and someday go to his future world and be among his pluralistic wives and all his children that I might have a glory.
Now, this is what is called the principle.
Yes.
Even though that principle, you died a little each time you did that.
Oh, absolutely. I say it's like having your skin peeled off your body.
Can you make the distinction for us between the polygamous view, the principle, and the Mormon view? Because we understand that in both cases, the man of a family, for instance, is trying to attain a godhood. We understand have maybe even his own physical place in the afterlife where his family will join him. What's the difference for polygamy?
Well, we believe the very same thing as the Mormons do. They believe that they will become gods someday, and they believe that they will have their own worlds and live eternally with their families.
Well, you know, for those who watch Big Love, the HBO series, where, you know, we see the wives competing for their husband's time, he never has enough time for them, and arguing over family decisions, if you could tick through some of the ways you had to live in order to live this life.
Well, we lived the first 12, 14 years without even any electricity. We didn't have any magazines, no newspapers, no radio. And I had two or three of the other wives living in the same house with cement floors, plain adobe walls that weren't even plastered. We drew our water from the well. And we suffered just trying to have the very necessities of life.
This was excruciating. It wasn't just that you were desperate for some time with your husband. You were a young girl, desperate for help in raising children. Just a hard, scrabble, painful life. But I'm wondering as I read it, Irene, especially for these, you know, beautiful kids whose lives often were in danger. They didn't have enough to eat. They didn't have enough attention. You did an amazing job, but you know, how could you keep track of not just your children, but often the children of other wives? I started thinking, you know, this is abuse.
Oh, absolutely, it's abuse. It's emotional abuse. And in our own group, just our group alone, I had 9 of my nieces and nephews that committed suicide. And it is so hard because I've seen people have nervous breakdowns and you're just stripped of every bit of your identity.
And just because we hear from them, what do you say? There are polygamous families now who claim that they're actually having, you know, wonderful lives in suburban Salt Lake, for instance, and that this maybe applies to the hardscrabble time that you had, but that it is possible to have a loving family through polygamy. I mean, I'm sure you hear from them.
Well, I put on a facade for years. I told everybody it was the perfect situation and that it was wonderful, and then I wept in my pillow at night. But I just want to ask you, how wonderful is it to go to your bed at night and listen to your husband in the next room making love to another woman and say that you're going to be happy?
You ultimately had an awakening. You actually became a born-again Christian and realized, in your words, that there was a different kind of God than the one you'd been brought up with. But I'm wondering, what is life for you like now, given the fact that some of your children, I believe, have entered a polygamist life?
I had 6 of my children into polygamy. At this time, I only have 3, and I think it'll be very soon before they get out of it. And the thing of it is, a lot of them are there just because of their circumstances. Where do you go when you've got 8, 9 children and no one to support you and you don't want to get on welfare? You have no job skills.
And we want to be clear, there's a Mormon now running for president, Mitt Romney, of course. But you tell of, you know, polygamists being ostracized not only by people outside the Mormon community, but by people within the Mormon community who disdained polygamy.
It's an embarrassment to all the Mormons that the fundamentalists are living polygamy. But the thing of it is, they even resent that we call ourselves Mormon fundamentalists. But it's funny, they call themselves Christians and don't think anything of it. But we live the fundamentals of Mormonism. In 1890, the Mormon Church gave up polygamy and no longer lived it. But we had been taught, all our grandparents and everybody, that it was for salvation, and they felt if they didn't live it, they were going to go to hell. So, of course, they carried it on.
It sounds as if you're saying that maybe the Mormon Church should take more responsibility for the polygamist sects that are out there. But it, from what you've said and from what we read, it seems as if it would be impossible to get someone to leave a polygamist sect until they, as you did, had an epiphany. It seems as if it's, it would be a very hard thing to do.
Well, I think it is, and even my book, I don't think it'll reach very many polygamists because they don't allow you to read any kind of novels or books. They're absolutely isolated, and when you're isolated, then people can control you. The thing that's sad is that every one of these women are giving up their identity, which I did. And when I left my husband, I left not to find another man, but I left to find myself.
Are there that many, Irene?
There's an estimated between 30 and 50,000 practicing polygamists in Western United States, Canada, and Mexico. And a lot of people estimate it a lot higher because there's so many of the polygamists that are under the radar. You know, your next door neighbor might be a polygamist and you may not even know about it.
That's Irene Spencer. She was the 2nd of 10 wives of polygamist Verlin LeBaron. She writes about her life in the book Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamist's Wife. And she is now a born-again Christian, happily married, and the only wife, we understand, of Mr. Spencer.
Yeah, I'm and the only wife of Hector J. Spencer, and he has made me the one and favorite and the only. I don't have any more competition.
Irene, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.